Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
They bought a business as every single year went by, increased in its profitability, sent back to the parent company $2 billion over the holding period that they've owned it. The big lesson was that they didn't change it.
Semprevic Partners' Tom Russo is on Consuelo Mack Wealth Track.
Funding provided by Clearbridge Investments, First Eagle Investments, Royce Investment Partners, Matthews Asia, Strategus Asset Management, and Women Investing in Security and Education.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. We have been witness to a market of some pretty far out extremes. The most obvious is Bitcoin, which experienced its worst quarter in a decade in the second quarter of this year. The dominant digital currency plummeted more than 56% in the 3 months ended in June. That is worse than its previous record loss for the decade of over 40% in the first quarter of 2021. I could not resist showing you this picture, courtesy of an online publication called Bankless Times. It shows Bitcoin's quarterly returns in recent years. A picture is worth a thousand words in this case. It also defies a verbal description. Bitcoin fans say this volatility is par for the course for an emerging technology and market. Well, on the opposite end of the spectrum is good old cash. According to Bank of America Global Research, cash rules. It has outperformed gold, bonds, treasury, inflation-protected securities, known as TIPS, and swamped the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond. Then there's a long-term stock performance extreme in the form of Berkshire Hathaway. According to Barron's, between 1965, when Warren Buffett purchased the former textile company, and the end of 2021, the conglomerate stock has delivered a compound annual return of 20.1% versus 10.5% for the S&P 500. As Barron's points out, most of that outperformance versus the index came in the early years when Buffett racked up huge gains in the stock market. Well, this week's guest is a longtime holder of Berkshire stock and an avid student of Buffett's style of value investing ever since meeting the legendary investor at Stanford Business School in the early 1980s. He is Tom Russo, managing member of investment advisory firm Gardner Russo & Quinn, where he oversees Semprevic Partners Funds, which he launched in 1983 after hearing Buffett address his class at Stanford. The global value manager focuses on owning a small group of exceptionally well-managed, well-known brand-name firms, many family-owned, with dominant, almost unassailable positions in their mostly consumer-oriented businesses, and then holding them pretty much forever. Berkshire Hathaway has consistently been one of his largest positions. I asked Russo why Buffett's talk in graduate school made such a huge impression on him.
I think it's just a tribute to the extraordinary mind and character that combined to form Warren. The mind has the processing capacity to describe everything that one experiences in the sense of investment opportunities and then advice for life about how to make sure that you live a decent and principled life, and the combination of each, I think, has been the joy as one who has been able to watch and listen and learn. It's both life lessons and it's investment 101.
What are the life lessons? I mean, that he has imparted to you, but especially in that first talk, did he actually give you some examples or some inspiration in that first Stanford Business School?
Yes. He talked about his efforts to try to go to work for one such person who was Ben Graham, and uh-huh. how he was summarily denied a position with Graham Newman, but why he had hoped so highly to go there. As far as the life lessons, I mean, there were countless over the years, but one of them is how strange it is that people are willing to give up what they have and they need for what they don't need and probably can't have. And it's an answer that so often arises when somebody asks Warren at the annual meeting, what the heck happened to Disney, or what the heck happened to this company or that company? And he'll say, you know, it's just the human mind doesn't recognize the risks of conduct that may expose somebody to lose what it is that they most value. I mean, the case of the Disney story, for example, Disney had a $5 billion loan in 1987 against a basket of holdings that they tried to correlate in a sophisticated manner with a trade with the against the S&P. And at some point, they had a margin call, and the $5 billion worth of pledge shares that were sold at a spanking discount went away, and they realized after the fact that they actually needed that $5 billion to feel the kind of wealth that they once had, but they sacrificed it. And Warren has a pretty sharp and quick answer as to what that suggests of him. Now, his partner, Charlie Munger, has quantified so many of his answers into what he calls behavioral science.
Poor Charlie's almanac, yeah. Right.
He said, remember that the stock doesn't know you own it, because people make the mistake of projecting their affection on an investment back as though there's somehow a reward. There's no reward. He says you don't have to make back your losses the same way you lost the money. So the big pitfall in investing is somebody takes an ill-advised position, it goes down. They say, I now understand it, I was wrong. When it gets back to my purchase price, I'll sell it. And then it just never does.
And to get back to that that Stanford Business School class,
yes.
was that a moment where you actually decided that you wanted to be a money manager, where you
yeah.
wanted to invest,
yeah.
And
yeah.
you wanted to be a value manager specifically? And just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the value part of it was it wasn't nearly so heralded along the different dimensions, because technology hadn't spilled into so much of our world awareness. I mean, the most valuable company in the world may be Apple Computer today, and think of it was in Palo Alto when I was there. I saw Steve Jobs talk at the business school.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take over life as technology has done so since, and so created this dichotomy, growth versus value. Now, in our world, as I said from the start, we're looking for businesses that have the capacity to reinvest. So we start out with the recognition that we have to have growth,
mm-hmm.
Or else we can't compound the value of our assets without triggering a sale and going off and finding something else that does grow. And we would prefer to stay with the businesses that have that ability to grow, and avoid the requirement of triggering a sale. I think our turnover over 3 or 4 decades has been less than 10% per
wow.
annum. So it's
right.
it sort of the goal there is to develop the big pool of tax savings that accompany a long-term minded investor.
But Tom, where did that idea come from? That your focus would be
yeah.
on number one, a very small portfolio
yes.
of companies
yes.
that have this capacity
yeah.
to grow and to reinvest yeah. and the capacity to suffer, as
yeah.
we'll talk about that in a moment. But
yeah.
did this come from Warren? Was he kind of the spark?
I think I became aware of this through the session that he spoke at.
Right.
He did talk about things that have remained true right through to the present tense. His board member Tom Murphy was asked about character, and he said at our session that many years ago, almost 30, that you can't make a good deal with a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about character. And as an investor, since everything's done through other people, we have high agency cost risk. And he said you can't write a contract sufficient to eliminate that risk. So you just have to be careful of who you choose as your agent. And he talked about the discrepancy between capital cities under Tom Murphy
right.
and ABC, the heralded network. And he had a story about the two of them going across the Atlantic. And they started at the same spot. Same day, and over the course of the journey, this enormous clipper ship shrank, and this little rowboat that Tom Murphy started out with grew. And by the time they got to the other side, the former ABC was a rowboat, and Cap Cities acquired it, and Cap
right.
Cities had done that. All based on the cumulative effect of treating people fairly, businesses investing properly, and maintaining the ethics that fueled that business in its extraordinary vault. Now, he, of course, had Tom as a board member for most
right.
of the past decade and a half. The story about Tom Murphy was really an epitome of the advice, which is find first and foremost somebody who you really respect.
Berkshire is the largest holding at Sempervic Partners.
Yes.
With Berkshire's as a kind of the stellar example
yes.
of
yeah.
of how a company, you know, should be managed and what they should look for as far as people that you would trust and have high integrity. So is that what you look for as well? Is the integrity and character of management
yes.
the most important
yeah.
characteristic of any company that you would invest in?
Yeah, and Warren says this when he meets with investors. He said, you know, one of the things you have to learn in life is that there's tragic outcomes if you happen to fall in love with a person who's mightily flawed, and you think that you can change the person. Because history is replete with examples
yes.
where that fails.
Marriages are replete with
yes,
examples of
yes.
that.
Yes, in the business world, you might say, this is a great company. I know the manager is a bit compromised, but the business is strong enough. I'll own it despite my lack of respect for the leader. That would not advance your cause very well. Because it can't be despite the leader, because you depend so heavily on that person setting the pace and sharing the values and managing the business for all owners, not just for the narrow few.
Two of the kind of the hallmarks of your investing approach is that you want to invest in companies that have the capacity to reinvest and also the capacity to suffer. And explain to us what that means. And did
yes.
those two ideas come from Warren Buffett, or did they evolve from your approach over the years?
For the capacity to reinvest, I think, really was from Warren, and it was from mm-hmm. the fact that when he came to that class in business school, he had really just made the transition from an old-fashioned value investor for whom price paid was the margin of safety. So the goal there was to come up with a value that could be realized in the near term. That value should be twice the market price, a 50-cent dollar bill, and in came the investor to release that and move on to the next sort of investment. But Charlie came along and said to Warren, you know, by the way, economic goodwill is extraordinary because it grows over the years. It doesn't shrink. It's not a wasting asset. It's a growing asset. And they first stepped their water in that field with the investment in See's Chocolate.
Mm-hmm. See's Chocolates. Mm-hmm.
For $30 million, they bought a business as every single year went by, increased in its profitability, sent back to the parent company $2 billion over the holding period that they've owned it. And they had enough sense that the big lesson was that they didn't change it, even though they had a, you know, opportunity to do what other firms did in that same business, which is they hire a consultant who would survey the numbers and say, well, you know, the problem is you only sell chocolate, you know, 8 weeks of the year. You have to put a soup kitchen there, an ice cream company in the summer, soup in the winter, somehow diversify for full season. And the insight that made them so much money at Berkshire was that no, C stands for premium chocolate with high integrity and great lasting consistent flavor. And it's a temple of chocolate, and
right.
By maintaining that insight, it meant that they didn't destroy what they bought. And of course, the thing is, you have to suffer 8 months of the year if you want to make a profit for the full year. And by suffering, it means that they just literally leave it as a candy store for the full 12 months, 4 months of which are active, mainly around the holidays, 8 months of which you carry it as just a dead loss. And that was a complete transformation.
Wow, what a revelation.
And that was back in the early 1980s. And it's something that this notion of the capacity to suffer kind of came from that awareness. In my world, it's a different capacity to suffer. It's the capacity for management to actually make the investments that are needed to develop excellence and not make investments that are desired by Wall Street, who invariably ask too little of a business, and hence you underinvest, and the cycle that we want to engage, which is invest heavily, create new products, increase the margins that flow from innovation and acquisitions. It's impossible to do that without with that long-term mindedness, without disrupting and diminishing reported profits in the near term. And managements who are charged with delivering the full value for reinvestment have to have the capacity not to lose their job, not to not to have the takeover team clear the deck or reduce their authority.
Or the activist investor.
Protected. Yeah, and the protection that we seek very often comes from family-controlled companies because they can say, go away, you know, we have control. And yet that doesn't stop them from coming. So we have Pernod Ricard has as an activist in it. Johann Rupert Sirichmann just received the knock on the door from an activist. Nestle had one. Cadbury Schweppes had one. I mean, the portfolio that we oversee, there have been dozens of approaches.
So what would happen if an activist investor came and knocked on Berkshire Hathaway's door?
Well, I mean, there have been people. One is the statement, you're nothing but a conglomerate. And you may remember conglomerates never did well in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. So why do you think they'll do well today? And the answer there is they're not just a conglomerate. They're an integrated business where capital flows to the highest use as regulated by a person of Warren's talent to comfortably starve businesses that don't deserve more capital and feed voracious amounts of capital to those that can convert it to the greatest growth and intrinsic value on a per-share basis. Emphasize that per-share basis in Berkshire's context today, not 3 years ago, but today, includes their willingness to buy back stock. And so the per-share value of Berkshire today has changed because they've spent over $60 billion on share buybacks, which only began 2 or 3 years ago. But that's a big enough amount that they've really incremented their intrinsic value on a per-share basis through deploying new capital to share buybacks.
Tom, can you give us an example of an instance where Berkshire, you know, took capital away from one of their companies that didn't need it?
See's is a perfect example. I mean, every year they send money back to Omaha. When Clayton Homes believes that they have an investment opportunity, they have no spare cash. Warren flies them up to Omaha in the private jet. They have lunch. And Warren, in the course of lunch, asks him three questions. And he said that invariably after the second question, he knows the right answer, and he owns it because the way the questioning steered. That is extraordinary and means that the capital goes to the right spot. And if it's not right, just drop the money and wait. And there's no shame whatsoever in not deploying the capital.
Is there any other leadership in any other company that you think could duplicate what Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger have provided as far as their investment and business acumen and their moral leadership?
Well, it's a great question. I ask myself of it all the time. The combination of having the insurance company in the hands of Ajit for all these years, where he literally nearly never lost money, but because of their clout in that industry, they alone were capable of making good on pledges to insure, so they received the opportunity to get the best risks for them, which are the ones that have the highest threat that they can diversify with their huge pool of capital. Mm-hmm. And so they have the pool of capital to deploy in equities and in investing in new companies. And so the insurance ultimately gives them interest rate free capital, because right. the float has continued to grow into other industries. But the coincidence of starting out 50 years ago with a very small stipend inside the regulatory capital of the insurance company means that today the regulatory capital is enhanced by all of the advances that have taken place, and that means that that capital is preferred, and they're able to use it to be greater than anyone else in the insurance industry, which gives them a pole position.
Sounds like it's hard to duplicate.
I think it's very hard to duplicate, and it's certainly not wise to separate. There is, the activists will frequently come by and say, let's break it up. And
right.
there's a huge tax benefit for staying inside the parent company, because capital can move throughout the company without taxes being
right.
paid.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this enormous portfolio of businesses that contribute to the advancement each year that you wouldn't get full value for if you were to separate them. And so I think it's well worth keeping the tax benefits, the capital flow, and the discipline. And it'll be known over time whether Greg Abel, Todd Combs, and Ted Weschler as a team, there's an insurance component that has to be met as well, because Ajit will pass at some point. Whether that team has the capacity to continue the brilliance that mm-hmm. Warren used to simplify what is an extraordinarily challenging business, deploying that kind of capital. But what we're living through today gives you an example of why his patience pays off. I mean, he would have the pick of the litter today in mm-hmm. businesses that are down 60-80% in value, just with a pool of capital. So we'll see what comes out of this. From Berkshire's perspective,
is a succession the biggest risk? I mean, you 18% of your portfolio is in Berkshire Hathaway out
yeah.
of your 17 holdings.
Yeah.
So that's a big position. What's the risk in holding that much Berkshire?
Well, it's not. Clearly there's a concern over age and health and all of the rest. But the truth is that's pretty well disclosed. It's not as if the market doesn't already have a sense of those risks with both mm-hmm. Charlie and Warren. It's partly why the shares have for so long commanded such a big discount from intrinsic value. And so I think I have a feeling that we're pretty aware of the risks and the business is in a position to move if something happens on the share price upon news of any change. Now that they already exercised the share buyback option, they can, at any point where there's a share price decline based on change of circumstances, they can act with a huge appetite and reduce the shares dramatically at a substantial discount to intrinsic value. And so that's why the $60 billion share buyback that's happened to date is ceremonially extremely valuable, because it means that upon a moment of crisis, the license from historical conduct of Warren will enable his temporary successor at that point to deploy enormous capital to take advantage of the discount if it happens.
And at the end of every Wealth Track, we ask all of our guests for the one investment for a long-term diversified portfolio. But
yes.
What would your one investment for a long-term diversified portfolio be?
It's such an unfair question, because there's so many. There's so many interesting ones. But it should come from that which I have backed. In this case, it would be Nestle. It's global growth prospects, it's management, it's increased use of their balance sheet through buybacks and extraordinary sequence of acquisitions. I would say that would be second to Berkshire.
Thank you, Tom, for being generous with your one investment recommendation. Thanks, Tom, for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, as always.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's Action Point repeats some advice we gave you when Tom Russo was on Wealth Track several years ago, well before the bear market began. And if you had followed it, you would have been better off financially today. It comes from the Oracle of Omaha himself. In his 2018 annual report, Warren Buffett vowed, "I will never risk getting caught short of cash." This week's Action Point, never risk getting caught short of cash. Cash is king, especially when you need it most. Make sure you have a stash on hand to meet those emergencies and opportunities that will and do appear, some when least expected. Warren Buffett has vowed that Berkshire will forever remain a financial fortress. In your own much smaller way, it pays to become a personal financial fortress as well. Next week, another in-depth interview on how to achieve long-term financial security in the midst of economic changes and volatile markets. In this week's extra feature, Tom Russo discusses his personal commitment and involvement in the Winston Churchill Foundation of the United States. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. Thank you for watching. Have a great weekend and make the week ahead a healthy, profitable, and productive one.